I don't even know what that's from.
It's just weird. It's just weird. Okay.
I'm grateful for that. Thanks, Ryan.
Check, test, clap.
Nice. Okay. So today we are talking about practicing gratitude and positive reframing. So principle of happiness, turn frustration into fuel. So the hook is every day brings little annoyances, traffic, rude emails, spilled coffee, missed deadlines. And we tell ourselves we'll feel better once life calms down, or we'll feel better once X happens, but it never does. The secret isn't avoiding frustration, it's alchemizing it. Happiness doesn't come from everything going right. It comes from training your mind to find meaning even when things go wrong. So the big idea is you can't control every setback, but you can control the story that you tell yourself about it. And that story determines your emotional reality. So this is an interesting one for me, because one of my favorite things, there's this, what's the speech called? It's not a commencement speech. The speech that you give at the graduation. I can't remember what it's called.
Commencement speech sounds right to me.
Sounds close.
Is it? But isn't that when you're commencing, like starting this thing? Maybe it is.
I'm not sure what they.
But anyway, there's one called This Is Water. I think I've shared it with both of you guys, by David Foster Wallace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what he's basically talking about, is about finding meaning even in the hard times in our life. And people are constantly thinking, I will be happy when X happens in my life. It's usually when I make X amount more money. And then when you reach that plateau, it never really finds the happiness. And we see the same thing in like celebrities, that like people think, oh, if I was famous, I would be happy. And then they get the fame and then they go batshit crazy, right? And they don't find happiness. So it's just that's the thought experiment here is, imagine two coworkers facing the same problem. Both are told their project pitch didn't get approved. Person A thinks, great, weeks of wasted work, I'm always overlooked. And person B thinks, good, now I can tighten the idea and make it bulletproof. So, foundational questions. Why does the human brain fixate on what's wrong more than what's right? Like, why do we have this natural instinct to think I'll be happy when? What do you think that is?
I think that's... makes sense. So negative things are a lot more dangerous than positive things, right? So it's a matter of life and death. You need to be able to see what could kill you and be hyper aware of that, rather than what more you potentially could get, right? So it makes sense that the negative is more threatening and has more potential to do you a lot of harm, and harm is kind of more important to us than, you know, thriving or whatever. So,
yeah, it almost sounds like you're saying that from an evolutionary perspective, that evolution isn't driving to optimize for happiness. It's right. Driving to optimize for survival, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, also, the unhappiness is not the opposite of happiness. Like, they're not one-to-one. Reducing your unhappiness doesn't necessarily make you happier. It makes you less unhappy. And so I think that that's probably part of it too. Like, I agree, Justin, that when you're hyper aware of the things that can cause you harm, fear is a motivator much more than progress. I'm much less concerned that I'll have more than enough than I am going to have not enough.
Yeah.
It's sort of a luxury of having won the evolutionary game to be able to think about happiness, because for hundreds of thousands of years, it was not something you would consider. It was just don't die, basically. And so now we're like, there's no threat to us dying. We have amazing buildings and cars, like food, all the food we could ever want. And so then this is sort of like a luxury to kind of think about.
It's to the point where, like, you see these videos of people like, in Yellowstone or something, they're like walking right up to like these
buffalo.
Yeah, and it's like
looking into the geyser.
There's no survival instinct there at all.
Because we've had so many generations of not even having to worry about it. It's like doom da doom.
I want to pet it.
Yeah. Is gratitude a personality trait or a skill that you can train like a muscle?
Well, I think there's probably some people who have more proclivity towards just a positive outlook in general. That's true, I think. But if it's not something that you can develop, then that would be really depressing, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah. I think it's something you can develop.
I think
sure.
so.
Yeah. When does optimism become denial or like unhealthy? Remember last time we talked about that movie that Life is Beautiful, where he's in a concentration camp and he's making up this make-believe world for his son so he can be happy about their situation and not have to deal with the reality of it. One of the thoughts I had that I didn't voice was like, I wonder if that's really a good thing that like if you like maybe being somewhat in touch with reality can be helpful in helping you get to a new place where it's easier to find happiness, right?
Yeah. When somebody's optimistic tells a pessimistic person that they're pessimistic, the pessimistic person will say, no, I'm realistic. Mm-hmm. So the pessimistic person thinks they're realistic when the optimistic person might not be under the illusion that they're not optimistic. So I think there's some value in it. I wonder if part of the danger is when it causes you potential harm, that's one. But really, if it spills into the lives of others. So if I'm overly optimistic, and so I'm like, I'm all in on this project, but then I lose all my money and my family suffers. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've met people that are just pushing on a startup idea, and it's like, okay, dude, like, you're not getting traction on this and it's been a long time and you're wasting a ton of time and energy. And they're just super optimistic. They're like, yeah, I think we're just about there. We're just about there. And that's always a hard line to draw between, are you being overly optimistic and not being tied down to reality? Or are you, I don't know. Is there like guidelines that you think we can follow for that?
I think there's like some kind of ratio or something that would have to be like you're 60% realist, 20% pessimist, and 20% optimist, you know, or something like that. And they all have their role to play and they're all good in their own scenario. Mm. And so the problem that a lot of people like who would consider themselves optimists probably have is they're like 60% optimist. Right. And so then that can get them into issues or like entrepreneurs. If you're going to start a business, you're going to have to be an optimist about it, mm-hmm. you know, or else you're never going to do it. And basically everyone else in your life is going to take the role of the pessimist. And so there's a lot to overcome there. And so but there has to be a healthy realism in there, you know, just to balance it out and maybe even some pessimism to sort of keep from going off the deep end of, you know, losing all your money and whatever. I'm on a hot streak at the casino. I know I'm, you know, or whatever.
It's always going to go well.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of what you're talking about though is not necessarily realism of what is. Like the optimist that you're describing is somebody who is certain that the future is going to be better than the current time. They might be realistic as far as it's not working right now, but they're overly optimistic of what will be. And so I think it goes back to one of the thoughts that you were saying before of how do you perceive the situation? It's not that you can't be realistic. I think a realistic person who wants to be happy sees what is, but then frames it, which is not the same, reframes it, which is not the same thing as denying what is. So you could be optimistic and denying the bad things or pessimistic and denying the good things, but probably the one who is the most happy is the one who sees what is and just reframes it. It's like that old saying, you're either winning or learning instead of winning and losing. You're reframing losing as an opportunity to learn and gain instead of I'm a failure.
Yeah, that brings us back to that first thought experiment where your project doesn't get approved. Mm-hmm. And person A is thinking, great, weeks of work wasted and I'm always overlooked, and the other person's still seeing the same thing, but they're framing it as good. Now I can tighten the idea and make it more bulletproof.
But even that is, I like that, but even that is external. Like, they're reframing it, so now I can improve this outside product. But I think maybe a higher level or a different kind of reframing is, I can learn from this and become a better engineer, designer, whatever. I'm improving. I can take this loss and become more resilient. You know, so it's not just reframing whatever's outside of me, but saying, how can I use this to become a better me?
Yeah. Do you think that when I think about it, I think realists are more about the present, and then optimism and pessimism are more about the future, right? So, you know, and that's kind of what you were saying too, whereas, you know, what is right now, and then you reframe it either in a future orientation of this is going to work out or this is going to be a disaster, you know? And I think that's pretty interesting to think about. There's something else you were saying, Tim. About the reframing the loss as learning, you know, I tip heavily towards realism, but so I would take it more like, well, the reality of it is that you did lose, but also the reality of it is that you can learn from losing, you know, like you don't have to deny that you lost. But that doesn't mean necessarily that should destroy your confidence or anything, but because there's positive things that come from losing.
Have you seen those things that talk about why dumb people excel?
I don't think so.
Well, part of it is they don't know that they're losing, like, you know, so they just keep going and they're happy and they're like, oh, this is great, you know.
Yeah.
It's an interesting study, but I like what you're saying there, like being realistic, but then being intentional about thinking about it. I think it's okay to allow yourself to feel the loss. And in fact, I would argue that if you don't lean in and actually feel the feelings that are appropriate for the moment, then you're actually stifling growth. I think we are meant to experience a full range of emotions appropriately and realistically. But so don't try to push that aside, but then come out of that and say, okay, it's also true that I can grow and I won't do that same mistake again. And now I can have empathy towards somebody else who's been through it. Like,
yeah, because
what
I see a lot of times is people will fail and then they'll just like, I'm never going to do any of that stuff ever again. Like, that's the conclusion. And so they don't reframe it and see it as nothing positive came out of that experience and nothing positive could ever come out of that, you know? And so it's like very pessimistic. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think people secretly enjoy complaining? Like, this idea of misery loves company. Like, it's almost like that's probably what it is, right? Mm. They want, if they've failed at something, they want to know other people have failed too in that similar way, and that provides them comfort. They want other people to fail.
Mm.
Is that?
I'm not sure.
That's probably what it, like, think about it. If you do bad on the test, and then everybody else does bad on the test, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something about misery or victimhood or however you want to kind of frame it, that is comforting in the sense that it's much more difficult to live a heavy life of carrying responsibility for everything, right? So when you're sort of miserable or you're the victim of your circumstances, you don't really have responsibility to do anything. It's like this has been forced on you. It's not your fault. It's not your, you know, rather than something like, I have to take responsibility for this. I have to overcome this. There's all this work and effort and whatever. And then also people won't really hold you responsible and force that on you. They'll give you comfort and they'll give you understanding, and it's sort of like positive emotions from other people rather than negative emotions. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of that goes into it, that reinforces it.
Yeah. I think there's a different kinds of one way of framing that. And I understand the saying means like, I want to help recognize that others around me are also miserable, and I want to make them miserable so that I don't feel so bad about myself. There's that aspect. But there's also the other aspect of when you're mourning or hurting, just the presence of somebody else, and even somebody who's walking through that pain with you in some way brings a lot more healing. I just had a conversation yesterday with a guy who was married for 13 months and his wife died. And it was a tragic accident. And he said, you know, people will say stupid things, and because they don't know. And we talked about that. They don't know what to say. Right. They're not trying to be mean, but it doesn't make it okay. And he said, really, what I want them to do is just shut up and sit with me. Like, now, it happened a long time ago. It's not fresh. But we were talking about that misery loves company can be also, as we're talking about it, reframing it as, what does that also mean? It also means that having some camaraderie through something like that. One interesting study showed, this was from Arthur Brooks. I mentioned him not long ago. He said, why do people listen to sad music when they break up? And he said, it actually brings good things. Like you recover faster than if you go out and you party with your friends and whatever. If you're sad, listen to sad music, you actually recover faster. So I don't know.
Instead of avoiding it and trying to force yourself to feel joyful and stuff like that. You know, I've been miserable in my life, and I agree. That's how it does work, is you do want somebody to comfort you and be there with you and validate it and say, yeah, this is a terrible scenario. I feel bad for you. I want to help you, you know, not to necessarily tell you what to do, you know, but to just be there and be a presence. And then that's kind of what music does too in those scenarios. It's sort of like, look, somebody understands, somebody gets me. They also have experienced this. So you kind of feel this connection and like you're not all alone in the scenario.
So it seems like there's a difference between, and I think rightfully so, somebody who's just is a complainer and a victim and it's everybody else's fault and pity on me and somebody rescue me and I don't want to take care of any of the things that I'm supposed to take care of. There's a difference between that and just processing something temporarily.
Yeah. So the misery loves company phrase, I think, is like these like pathological people who want to bring misery upon other people so that they can be comforted by the misery of others.
So I think, I wonder if this is the same thing of like, when I jump in the water and it is cold, I still want everybody else to jump in the water.
So you like, tell them it's not cold.
It's not that bad, you know, it's not that bad. Is this the same feeling? Is that like...
You want them to suffer too?
I don't feel like I'm wanting them to suffer, but for some reason I'm compelled to tell them like, hey, just jump in, just jump in. Yeah, not that bad.
I don't know. I wonder if that has something to do with the bonding that goes along with it. When I was a kid at camp, that's something they would do. Every morning they would go out and they'd jump in the lake, and it was called polar bearing because the water was super cold. And if you went every day of the week, then you got a special prize at the end. And so at the beginning, we're all trying to recruit each other to do it. And by the end, there's like three kids that actually made it, but they have this bond. Hey, we're the guys that did. So I wonder if there's part of that too. It's like the friendships that you make in war, because you've been through something incredibly painful and tragic together. And, you know, people who have been through divorce can understand each other better. And so I wonder if part of it is you want to build some camaraderie with people, maybe instinctively come share in my misery so that we can have a bonding experience. I don't know.
I think you nailed it.
I think you just want people to suffer.
I think so. I think you're right, though. It's the feeling is that I want to know that there's people that are going to be there for me during these hard times. And then if you get them to, you know, come in and be in there with you, you know that you've got someone, like you said, in war, things like that. If you've been through the hell of war together, like you probably, anything else life throws at you, you're going to be able to be there for each other, kind of thing. So is gratitude about accepting fate or reframing it? Or both?
I could see how those would be part of the same process. So, you know, gratitude, I guess it doesn't necessarily matter, but I guess I'm always impressed when people can be grateful for a bad experience. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a good experience, I guess, but would make sense to be grateful for those too. But when someone, like the tragedy you're talking about, you know, if somebody can come out of that and be grateful, like, well, I'm grateful for the time we had together. I learned all these things about myself. I was able to build a better bond with Tim because I had to go through that, you know, and see those kinds of things. That always impresses me, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would reframe the question just a little bit. Like, by fate, are you thinking of, like, reality of what is? Like,
yeah.
Okay. So I don't think they are necessarily juxtaposed, and I don't think you have to pick one or the other. I think it's kind of what Justin was saying, where they work together in some way. You don't necessarily have to be grateful for the event itself. And sometimes you have to look away from the event, whatever it is, or the experience, to find gratitude so that you can gain enough strength to look back into the experience to see the good things that can come out of it. Maybe you've heard people say things like, I had a job I loved, I got fired from it, it was the best thing that ever happened. Like, in the moment it wasn't, because it was tragic, and then they had to look around and go, wow, I still have a good family, and I've got a friend that cares for me, and I still have my health. And so you look outside of the thing, and then you look back in, and then you say, okay, what did I contribute to this? And then you find a different job or whatever it might be. So I think it can be kind of both. You're accepting what is and being grateful for what is, but then you're also reframing it. So I don't know.
Do you think gratitude could ever be a negative thing, or like hold people back? I've never thought about that. It just crossed my mind right now. Maybe not. I don't know. Like,
that's a tough one, because I think gratitude in general brings lots of positive things. There's so many studies about health that comes out of gratitude and all of those things. But I do wonder if, like, gratitude can lead to complacency, or, you know, I'm so thankful for what I have, I don't want to move forward. But then there's the other story. Have you ever heard of the book called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari?
I don't think so. Okay.
Uh-uh. Yeah. Well, it's about a guy who was a lawyer, and he made tons of money, had a heart attack, and he was given a second chance. And so he goes and spends time with monks, and then he comes back and he's different. And he had everything that he was trying to attain before, but then he had a much better life before with less. So I wonder if reframing the drive towards a different destination can be part of it. So over gratitude, perhaps if you're grateful for the things that aren't really driving you towards fulfillment and health, then you might be, it's like the old story of you get to the top of the ladder and you realize your ladder's leaning against the wrong building. You know, it's like you can keep driving towards the gratitude, but then you're like, oh, well, there's a better one over there, but I'm too far up this ladder to get there easily. I don't know.
Yeah, so maybe like a properly oriented gratitude towards the things that are real, you know, like that matter.
That actually matter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so you shouldn't be grateful for the money you're making on OnlyFans.
That's right. They actually
How did you know I was on there?
I have a negative account. I don't know how that happens. OnlyFarms, that's...
Okay, so... We've kind of talked a little bit about, like, okay, it is important to be grateful and to kind of reframe these things in these certain frameworks. But what are the different, like, how could we create an environment? I want to shift to that. How can we create an environment where we're able to more naturally gravitate towards having gratitude in our life? So some of the behaviors that biases that are at play here, negativity bias, you can overcorrect by writing down 3 positive moments each night, not grand ones, just small sparks that went right. Reframing effect strategy, keep a good file, a note or journal where you log daily frustrations and relabel them as growth opportunities. So it's like the idea is like you it's kind of interesting. You like write down all the negative things and then how can I reframe these? And then just train your neural pathways to reframe them. Availability heuristic, surround yourself with reminders of past wins, photos, notes, testimonials. So the availability heuristic is we pay too much attention to the things that are right around us. Commitment bias, join or create a gratitude group.
What?
Reciprocity bias. Reciprocity bias? I can't say it.
Reciprocity?
Yeah. Express gratitude out loud to others. When you thank people, they respond warmly, reinforcing the cycle. Yeah, I don't know. Any ideas of like if you were to try to create an environment that would nudge you into having more gratitude, what are some ideas that you guys might have? I think it's interesting. It always kind of comes back to the same things. It's almost like you need a community, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
You need a community where people are doing these things, you know, publicly thanking people. One that I do that's really fun, and it's just one of my weird things that I do, is I always look, whenever I'm being served by someone at like a restaurant or like there's an employee or whoever, a lot of times they'll have a name tag and no one's ever called them by name. And so I'll just glance at it and then, you know, after they do something, I'll be like, thank you so much, Roger. And they're just like, totally like blindsided, like, does this person like know me? Like, and then they just, they can't, it takes them a minute to come to. But yeah, so maybe one way that you could do it is just make a rule for yourself that you're going to have to thank every stranger or something.
Yeah, well, everybody who has served you in some way, I think that might be easier than every stranger.
Yeah, everyone that's served you
in some way. Yeah, I think that's a good one. It is interesting. It comes back to some of the same things, like habit forming to reinforce a certain thing. I would even think that avoiding things that you have no control over, as far as bad things, like bad news cycles. If I have no control or input and it's really not going to affect my life directly and I don't have to make any decisions based on this information, then I just avoid that negative part of the news cycle. That's kind of the opposite side of developing the gratitude. Mm-hmm. But I think the heuristic, the proximity of heuristic, that what it is, that everything is nearby. Well, if everything that's nearby is the negative stuff that's really far, far away, then that's not good. But if you just let the far stuff be far, then maybe that'll help us to be more grateful for the things that are close up.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking too, was the first place my mind went was you got to stop being around negative people, you know, like and I know that that's tough for a lot of people because a lot of the people that they're around are negative people, you know, family members and, you know, stuff like that. So it's easier said than done, but, replace those people with people that are grateful. You know, I feel like the church has done a lot of work on trying to, on the gratitude thing over the years, you know, so they probably have the most insight as to what kind of practices and, you know, gratitude journals and sort of habits you can develop to put it into your daily life.
So just for the record, you're telling people to join a Christian church is what your
That's right.
your main thing
just
is?
Just mine.
Yeah.
Okay.
The address is. So I, you know, that's been a thing. So
well, I wonder if that's interesting. So I wonder what part of faith or religion, of course, the one I'm most familiar with is Christian, but there's others as well. A built-in part of that is expressing worship in the form of, or gratitude in the form of worship. So I wonder if there's just something intrinsically within us that just the expression of that just changes our mindset, our mood, probably some chemical reaction internally, hormonal, you know, whatever it might be, especially if you're doing it in community with others, in alignment. I wonder if there's something to that. I would guess so.
Yeah, my biggest, another big takeaway is, I mean, like for an environmental step you could take, you could do like you could carry around a notebook and then whenever there's a frustration, you could write that down And then that kind of like lets it go a little bit, just the fact that you wrote it down. But then the other one that we commonly are coming back to is blocking off time. You could block off an hour a week where you're going to review the negative things and come up with a way to, what are the positive things that can come from this? That maybe would give you a little bit of distance so you're not as emotionally charged, and you're able to train your neural pathways to start thinking in terms of how do I flip this? How do I flip this? Yeah. How do I flip this?
I love that. Neil deGrasse Tyson on an interview recently was asked, what would you tell, it was the podcaster, what would you tell me? And basically he's saying it's another form of the same question of what would you tell this yourself 20 years ago? And he said, I'd tell him nothing. Like, why not? Well, because the lessons of the journey are too invaluable. Like, you won't learn the things you need to if I tell you the lesson in advance. So he said, I'd probably tell you something general, like keep learning, keep growing. I wouldn't tell you specific things to avoid. So that's kind of like the journal, like writing down the lessons that you can learn along the way, the reframing of the things. One of the frustrations that I've had in life is if you come across somebody who is 72 and they're complaining about every little problem in life, and there's not a ton, there are some, maybe you know more than I do. The reason I think that's frustrating is I think they've been through so much that the little things should no longer frustrate them. Like, it should only be the big things, because they realize, I'll get through this. I've been through this before. It's going to be okay. The young people should be the ones that are like, oh no, I didn't get that 25-cent raise. And you're like, your problems are so small, like compared to what's coming down the road, you know? I think what you're talking about would help somebody grow over time so that when they're older, things don't frazzle them and they can see the good out of the bad, whatever bad thing can come.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks guys. I guess, Justin, can you give us the very best piece of advice of this podcast real quick?
And then the best piece is surround yourself with good people.
Okay. Yeah. No, I honestly think that probably is like you said, joining this Christian church, surrounding yourself by the best people, right? No. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm grateful.